hand over to the speakers. Thank you so much for joining us today, and you can start.
Great, thank you very much, Maria. I'll just start sharing my screen to open up the PowerPoint. I hope everyone can hear us properly.
Yes, we can hear you and we can see the PowerPoint.
Excellent. Then just start from the beginning. Thanks for these kind words of introduction. I consider our input a little bit more modest, but that's being Finnish for you. This is actually what Mona and I have been working on is pretty much a hobby of ours. We have discussed academia-related things throughout our careers together. We've commiserated, we have celebrated some achievements, and hey, why not publish on it as well? And this is based on our second contribution, which some of you may have read, an article in the European Journal of Cultural Studies, and there's a third one in on the drawing board, maybe in a very early stage, and Mona may say something about some initial thoughts that we have for a third article, because this really needs to be a trilogy. The first part of this, perhaps someday to be a trilogy series of articles, this slide is here only for basically a plug for the first article, which basically took up the concept of the middle ranges of agency, which is a small idea in Eve Kosofsky Sedgwick's touching feeling in one of the chapters there. And we took that concept and kind of tried to think through ordinary academic workers and how potentially there might be room for micro-emancipations in university work through that idea. I won't go into that any further because we want to focus on the current stuff. And it starts from the idea that academic time competes with business time all the time. And in fact, academic time is much kind of needs a longer term focus than business time. A professor emeritus, this kind of Finnish all around know-it-all columnist, Kari Enqvist, said that the quarter of academic time is in fact 25 years instead of 3 months like it is in business, making the academic business year 100 years. So business time doesn't really fit the university world's concept of time at all. We live in a constant time bind or a time contradiction or constriction in the university, which is, as you can see on your right hand side, or depending on how how this projects, maybe it'll also be on your left hand side, but you can see in the column that the university nowadays is characterized in temporal terms such as fast paced. It's also neoliberal, managerialist, entrepreneurial, and performative. And in this kind of university, the ideal employee is someone who never wastes time. Already 20 years ago, Oili-Helena Ylijoki and Hans Mäntylä stated that university time has accelerated. And they were in search of something that we wanted to kind of also take up. They're in search of timeless time, the feeling of flow or freedom, which in their interviews pretty much existed either in the past or in the future somewhere, sometime, but not necessarily in the here and now. So we kind of also want to look for this kind of timelessness instead of this hyper-focus on timeliness or quickness and fastness. Now, we know that in academic working life, work-life balance is difficult. Problems of time management are privatized, okay? And this is also the case in the time management trainings that Mona and I participated in. They specifically teach individuals how to manage their time better and how to solve your own problems. And this is by no means a new thing. This is something that Mona, as a historian, knows very well. Whenever there is this kind of current phenomenon, historians are the first to say, this is actually not new. We can find something similar in the past and maybe learn from it. So already in the 19th century, people were thinking about how, for example, housewives or factory workers could manage their work better in terms of time, because the ideal employee optimizes everything that they do, including time use, because work is performative. Repetitive actions create the reality of work, and productivity is maximized by prioritizing which tasks take priority and which tasks are secondary. But not everybody has the opportunity to manage their time in an autonomous or fully independent way. The use of time in an academic context, as we see from the research literature that we've consulted, is very much gendered. Okay. Icelandic researchers, Raffinsdottir and Heistra, pointed out that women suffer from time poverty, okay? And this comes from Iceland, okay? So they have the highest birth rate in the Nordic countries or in Northern Europe. So this means that they are the ones who should have the best conditions for women to combine family and work. Still, they talk about this poverty of time. Then there's also the discourse of competition between and within universities. Universities and researchers need to brand themselves in order to stand out in the competition. But there again lies the time problem. If you look at the Twitter logo there and the quest for self-promotion across different social media platforms, the question then becomes, at what time, on whose time, do you self-brand yourself on social media like Twitter, which is quite time-consuming. So not only social media and self-branding creates this time conundrum, but also the profiling of different universities creates time rhetoric. For instance, during the last rector's term, the University of Turku, our university, branded itself as an entrepreneurial university. And the PR materials speak about, for instance, there's a YouTube video, watch it if you feel like it, which kind of rides on the slogan of the university that never sleeps. And the PR materials regarding the entrepreneurship university were not only about entrepreneurship as such, as a mode of self-employment, but it was also about life attitude as a kind of ontological thing, how you become a productive entrepreneurial subject. And you produce more innovations, more capital, more products in a temporally optimized way. So the rhetoric used words like being entrepreneurial means that you are up to date, you're timely, you're current, somebody who seizes opportunities and is not left waiting or, worst of all, loitering. But we argue that the individual is not the only one to blame for time conflicts and for haste and anxiety, especially anxiety and guilt that follow such haste. Guilt appears as the primary, kind of the most dominant time-related affect in the research literature that we've read on the field. So as a remedy, we are offered time management training. And in my experience from a training that I attended in 2019 is that although the training gave a lot of insights and it was nice to kind of gather together and moan and complain in a small group and be aware of how time rushed we all are, it seemed to me that none of us actually needed training on how to do our jobs better. But the faults were actually elsewhere. There was, I'm not sure if I mentioned this in the article, but there was one colleague who had had a rush to finish all the work before a major surgery because they had to get all their work done because there wouldn't be a substitute hired to look after the job in their absence. And then another one represented a discipline that had this tradition of writing massive articles on minor languages. So the articles were extensive, publishing processes took time, and revision processes obviously took time for these huge, larger scale articles where you couldn't kind of salami slice the smallest possible publishable bit and maybe have it over sooner. So time doesn't always fit the institutional boundaries that we give it or that it is given, but still we try and manage it. And there is this entire genre of time management, guides, trainings, books, websites, all university websites, I claim, have their own time management resource pages. So just check if your university has such resources on its website. I'm pretty sure that there is. So there is a place in these where work is guided by means of emotions and power related to them, because we always talk about guilt and anxiety and all of these kind of time-related affects. And we seek alternatives to these kinds of methods by looking at some time-tested feminist methods like feminist consciousness, including awareness of community and collectivity and empowerment in relation to time and our use of time. So it's time for us to become time activists. Okay, Mona continues.
Yes, thank you, Elina. So as Elina said, I'm a historian by training, and I at the moment, I study the history of occupational medicine, actually, and more specifically, the history of work-related fatigue, which is today known as burnout. And while I've been doing this research, I have realized that a body without fatigue is an industrial utopia, which actually never happened, as we know, because also in post-Fordist society, people are exhausted. But as also in the university and also in other fields, the burnout, we are sort of experiencing burnout epidemics, or our age is called as the age of burnout. So it means that the employers, including our university, have to find solutions to work-related problems and anxieties, or they have to look like they are trying to do so. I mean, it doesn't mean that they are actually interested how we are feeling, but anyways. And these happiness-based solutions in times of austerity, in particular, are often connect neurobiology of positive affects with neuroeconomics, a field that elegantly moves from organizational science to economics and experimental social psychology. And perhaps this is something you have encountered, especially in the UK. But Finns, anyway, are keen to adapt every kinds of ideas from the US and from the UK, also this one. And we encountered neuromanagement in our university when its HR department hired a leadership and brain training professional trained by the Neuro Leadership Institute to give us tools for self-management and time management. And the Neuro Leadership Institute is a global initiative bringing neuroscientists and leadership experts together to build a new science for leadership development. And it operates in 24 countries, and the institute helps especially large organizations like university to operationalize brain research in order to develop better leaders, or in this case, workers. And I was very curious about this trend in 2017. So I attended to these trainings twice. They were called self-management. These are translated from Finnish, but anyways, there's something like this self-management and tend your brain. And I was actually also planning to do research about neuroleadership and this kind of phenomena, but I never got funding for that. So that's that. But the first training focused on brain fitness and neuroplasticity as nature's inventions to overcome the limitations of the genome and respond to the demands of a rapidly changing world. And this means, it sounds very complicated, but what it actually means, if you look at the picture, you can see that you can sort of modulate your brain to think positively and learn new patterns of work and life. And the second training, Tend Your Brain, drew on the idea of healthy mind platter that you can see in the picture. And the idea is quite simple. We have to understand how a healthy lifestyle and mental nutrition, which actually means healthy diet, are key to optimizing our brains to function better. And this is actually the same advice that was given to industrial workers 100 years ago, but then the focus was on the workers' body and their ability to work faster in the assembly line. But now the focus is more on cognition and how our brains work. The Healthy Mind Platter is developed by David Rock, Executive Director of the Neuro Leadership Institute, and Dr. Daniel Siegel, a clinical professor at the UCLA School of Medicine, and he's also an executive director of the MindSight Institute. So they have also kind of consultancy business alongside academic work. And like I said, their instructions for daily mental health activities are quite simple, like focus time, sleep time, play time, meet friends, and that sort of things. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, we think in the article, that we all know this. But the problem is that who has money, time, or resources to follow the rules of healthy mind platter? Well, executives. And not surprisingly, the idea of neuromanagement was first introduced to a group of Finnish executives at Aalto University in 2012 by Jeffrey Schwartz, a management consultant and a psychiatrist at the UCLA. Yet, for some reason, these ideas moved from top to down, from executives to workers via HR and occupational health initiatives. But is poor diet and lifestyle problems really the biggest problem amongst academics? I mean, this is a rhetorical question. We all know that the cause of academic despair is not the lack of self-discipline, but rather fragmented work and metrics that are detached from everyday life at the university. So in fast-paced academia, we do not need guidance to improve ourselves to become better and more productive. We need practical solutions that would help us to cope with multitasking, fragmented attention, and mental overload under precarious employment conditions. In this scenario, improving oneself can hardly be the only solution to time management issues. Oh,
sorry.
Academics do realize that workaholism is a risk for mental health, but limitless work is the lifestyle that entrepreneurial university promotes. So academics in the promotional university are already self-disciplined, but our experience in these workshops is, like Elina said, that academics are exhausted in solving work-related problems alone. Therefore, the atmosphere in the workshops was very friendly and communicative, including the brain consultant, who was very sympathetic towards the participants, as she herself mentioned that she's exhausted. I mean, it's not easy to run a consultant business. It seems then that the reasons why academics may find these kinds of personal trainings useful is not that they help them to regulate their unruly time management habits or lack of resilience, but rather that they create a safe space for sharing grievances collectively. So they actually don't work as they were supposed to. So what I actually learned in the trainings is that exhaustion is the new normal. I really didn't know how to deal with that. And now the next slide. But if academia is such a problematic place, why people desire to work here? I mean, many people, it's a very competitive working place. I have came to a conclusion that the partial answer is love, the partnering crime in the construction of self-exploitative work cultures. I myself, and I guess all of us, and Elina also, never grow tired of reading and writing. So I guess I could say I love my job. But a romantic relationship to academia is not merely a difficult relationship. It is a bad relationship. One that is based on one-sided love. Yet critical theories on problematic structures and changing these structures assume that there is order in the world, but a project like a work culture filled with desire is characterized actually by disorder. So drawing on Lauren Berland's analysis of affects, we suggest that love nurtures the tendency to exercise patience towards structures that are not actually working. And love gives us patience to be flexible even in psychologically damaging conditions. And this twisted relationship to work might best be explained by Berland's notion of cruel optimism, which we have used in the previous article, which is a description of an attachment that allows us to accept what is irrational in our attachments. I mean, attachment to academic work, it is really irrational. And in general, we all know that workaholism is bad, but in academia, greed is actually good. It is also true that success related to workaholism incites pleasure. And this is not to say that loving one's job is wrong, but rather that it offers a basis to an infrastructure that normalizes the repetition of exhaustive patterns. But we often forget that people do not experience these structures in the same way. And my perspective on the problematic structures is one of a mid-career researcher with a multidisciplinary academic background in the humanities and social sciences. And this is the new stuff. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it has been difficult for me to find my real, actual place in the academia. And in the picture from the PhD comics, you can see what has been my structure in the past 7 years after I have finished my PhD. And this is really, it's not a structure, it's a mess. I have worked in several projects and published a lot, but still I don't have any idea what I'm going to do next year. It's possible that I'm going to be unemployed. And in this precarious present, work is not a casual space, but a good worker is also an anxious one. Anxiety, as Vic Loveday puts it, is a symptom of neoliberal academia's structures of keeping people in hold. Anxiety is also an affect that circulates among people who are in a constant flux. Temporary contracts correlate with higher levels of anxiety among academics. In that sense, anxiety is performative, an affect that does things and works through us as we compete for an ideal self and job security, something that may or may not happen in the future. And as also Loveday remarks, anxiety is a driving force of competition. And for me, it seems like time is running out. I'm at my 40s, so I'm not young and potential anymore, but I'm also too academic to work elsewhere. And therefore, it is fair to ask how precarity fuels the cycles of fast academia and national fantasies of academic success. At the moment, the Finnish government and the universities want to educate more PhD and faster. And I cannot help but wonder what is the point in constructing a highly competitive, precarious environment where interesting issues are never actually explored because the next project is waiting and no one has time. Hopefully, at some point, we will reach a saturation point where we realize that there are more publications and projects than ever before, but it doesn't matter because no one has time to read or do basic research, which I think should be the key focus in a research university. Next. And academics talk a lot about research communities, but many of us precarious scholars feel that we are left alone, or that we are some kind of entrepreneurs of ourselves, especially if we move from one project to another. And when everyday life becomes a crisis, people tend to curl up in themselves, and at the same time, society looks for and it needs a diagnostic explanation for individual suffering. And manic self-observation, it is a phenomenon of our time, but I want to remind you, like historians do, that the effect of haste on the nervous system has been recognized throughout industrial history and history of medicine more generally. And just, I'm not going to tell you more about this, but just check out the history of neurasthenia. But you can see what I mean in the picture. And I would also like to remind you that many academics before us, mainly men, like Max Weber, were treated in sanatorium. And I have been reading Max Weber's letters lately from the sanatorium. And it remains a bit unclear what exactly was wrong with him, but he didn't do very well. But whatever was the case, he wrote to the university that asked them when they asked him to return for teaching. So he replied that if he would have to return to the university, I would have to shoot myself. So there is nothing positive in his condition. But for some reason, neurasthenia had this kind of positive spin because it's something, neurasthenic reaction is something that happens to people that are very active. So it was somehow seen as a positive.
Good work.
Yes, he had been working a lot. But if we think about today, the occupational health interventions require that work-related suffering should be located somewhere. And changing circumstances should perhaps force you as yourself and the employer to examine your own really unrealistic expectations towards work as well as the working conditions. And I myself have made some remarks about these issues while building or trying to build an interdisciplinary research career. Firstly, working in different environments has taught me several things, and my background has obviously equipped me with rich knowledge of various fields and perhaps even tools to survive in contemporary academia. However, academia is quite conventional and hierarchical, and I often feel like an outsider. In fact, I can feel a bit uncomfortable when someone asks what my actual field of study is. I would like to pretend that it is just my curiosity that has led me to this situation, but truthfully, it is the difficulty of making long-term plans in contemporary academia. And this is perhaps something that people who mentor early career scholars should take into consideration. And whereas interdisciplinarity, for instance, sounds like an exciting buzzword, the reality in interdisciplinary projects can be quite exhaustive and draining. Early career scholars, in particular, often need to change topics rather drastically according to the themes of the projects for which they are employed. Sometimes it also feels like the society puts unrealistic expectations on academic projects. They are expected to change the world, solve societal maladies, and yield an astronomical return on invest. But science is not magic. It often takes time to achieve results, build your own career path, and be able to design your own project in the future. Therefore, interdisciplinary projects or project culture may be a risky business for early career academics. It is true when they are needed just to tick a box, and their work is not actually noticed, but is solely incorporated, for instance, in the discipline of the principal investigator. It takes time to build academic relationships and to see the value in other approaches, but competitive, fast-paced academia does not always foster collegiality. The main risk for early career scholars working in interdisciplinary projects is that they may not offer career advancement, but rather advance someone else's strategic agenda or career. And therefore, early career scholars need to be aware of possible problematic power relations in the project. It's also easy to make a project look fantastic in the research plan, but it's actually in the shop floor where many boundaries are negotiated. And this includes epistemic boundaries as well as boundaries of work. And we tend to blame neoliberalism about everything. But as academics, we also have a possibility to decide what kind of research communities we build and how we lead the projects. I mean, no one forces you to be nasty. So we have some suggestions for improving the situation, which we can talk more. But these are very basic surveying working conditions in the projects because sometimes project workers cannot actually tell anyone how they are doing. And it's only the PI who is writing how the project, what were the results. And realistic work plans. So do not promise more you can actually do. And then it would be important also to not only to focus on future potentiality, and I forgot the very important thing, doing research work only for pay. So don't start doing projects before you are, don't do free work. And then it would be also important to focus on what is happening now or what has happened in the past, not only on the future potentiality. If someone has been productive before, it is likely that they will be productive in the future if they only have the right circumstances to do so. And then my final slide. Another antidote and act of resistance to the high-paced demands of academic labor today, slowness has gained new value. The slow university discussed, for instance, by Maggie O'Neill and the guide Slow Professors are one example of how we can respond critically to the ever-fastening pace of our work. Elina knows more about the book. But however, we need also to consider the ramifications of such a counter-movement. Are we damaging our own careers by resisting fast pace? And indeed, slow university thinking has been criticized as elitist. I mean, who has the opportunity to slow down? And it is true that sometimes time management guides enforce traditional hierarchies instead of redefining them. especially new mental resilience training software individualize and manipulate workers' emotions, although they seem like they are increasing freedom and communication. In this sense, it is doubtful if time management training or such can be a solution. And the problem with the time management genre in particular is that they are often rooted in a discourse of self-help, where the therapeutic discourse speaks benevolently but powerfully on responsibility side individual who works on the self. Thus, time management is effective. It relies on and circulates Puritan work ethics by emphasizing classic Christian ideals of, I'm quoting Melissa Gregg here, confession, abstinence, and salvation, whereby work gains a religious status. And this is very typical in a Finnish Lutheran Christian tradition, where idleness is an unnatural and evil evasion, and therefore compulsive work arises from the guilt of not working, that is wasting time, like Elina said before. And here, time management not only helps the individual become a better worker, but also a better human, and in the case of Finland, a better citizen or worthy citizen. And here, each segment of life needs to be developed towards perfection and is thus apt for ambitious academics to happily pursue past the point where it is difficult to say what is actually more stressful, work, life, or the infinite instructions of how to perform them to perfection. And criticism hardly leads to collective resistance, but partly because academics feel like they have to participate on the academic game based on the survival of the fittest. And I feel like that myself too. But the neoliberal university, this is the positive side, is not a sovereign with coherent intentions. While academics complain about the collapse of collegiality, they fail to appreciate their own actions and behavior accentuated what they simultaneously decried. Should we then take back time? Should we then take back what is ours? Time. What is our understanding of productive use of time? Is it something different than offered in guidebooks originally targeted to top executives and their quest for self-development as well as productive and highly individualistic lifestyles? And many academics do not see any option but to comply with the rules of entrepreneurial university to maintain employment. However, there is always a possibility to bend these rules through mundane decisions, especially those that consider productive time use. We realize that there is criticism towards the idea of slow academia, but transforming the rules of the game does not necessarily mean that there is less research. Instead, there is better and ethically sustainable research. And this is our message, I guess, today. Oh. And we also have to remember that a growing sense of collectivity is a powerful antidote to the ailments of neoliberal university. However, we also need to turn our gaze to our academic habits. Are we learning to write badly to spare ourselves and selflessly survive in highly competitive surroundings in an era of mass publications? Instead of disrupting the hegemony of excellence by behaving as self-centered entrepreneurs, as suggested in the management discourse, we should turn to the core question of feminist cultural studies. Why are we so anxious about our productivity? What are the structural reasons for our experiences of time poverty? And which are our possibilities to change these feeling structures from within? The history of time management shows that the literature is directed to the members of the professional class and thus assumes you have the possibility to select which tasks you want to perform, how and in what order. As the writers of The Slow Professor confirm, time-tested feminist practices such as practices may open conversation, trust, shared experience and collaboration, certainly, and they certainly have their place here too. And perhaps this kind of academia that would reconsider or re-evaluate the use of time wouldn't glorify workaholics or literal Machiavellians, but it would support interdisciplinary research based on collegiality, co-working and sharing. And in this kind of university, scholars would have time to concentrate on their research rather than multitasking on several projects and writing numerous applications without getting money. In addition, academics wouldn't have to perform their productivity and future potentially on a daily basis. Instead, researchers would be able to take time for thinking, reading, writing, and discussing. So we want to go back to very basic things. So thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
I will do an audible clap on behalf of everyone else. Let me stop the recording.